Today's episode is brought to you by HEB Curbside and Delivery. When life throws you a loop, HEB Curbside and Delivery is here to help. We shop how you shop, so you get exactly what you want. Order today at HEB.com. HEB Curbside and Delivery. It's never been easier to shop HEB. The interview you're about to listen to is part of a larger video project produced by Laurel Media. That video is about how to counter violent extremism. This interview was conducted on the campus of Rice University at the James A. Baker Institute on September 6th, 2019, just 5 days before the 18th anniversary of 9/11. Thanks so much for joining us today for this episode of Our Voices Matter. Our guest has a really fascinating story, and I'm excited that he's able to join us. His name is Jesse Morton, and Jesse, looking at you, I would never believe that you used to be a recruiter for ISIS. How did that happen?
Well, actually, I was a recruiter and a propagandist for Al-Qaeda before ISIS. ISIS came about after my transition in 2011. So I was arrested 2 weeks after Osama bin Laden was killed in Abbottabad, in a time when we figured the war on terror would then wind down. I was arrested in Casablanca, Morocco. And it's interesting because an American kid like myself to go so far down the rabbit hole of jihadism is one of the conundrums that has plagued us throughout our current era in the post-war on terror era particularly, and by all accounts, I should have been just a general all-American boy. I was born in Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania. My father was a sort of a New Jersey affluent kid, son of a lawyer, an attorney, and went to study at a liberal arts school in rural Pennsylvania and met my working-class mother. And they conceived me and got married because of my birth. And they should never have been married because they were not a good fit. My father became an adulterer. And on my father's side, I actually go all the way back to the Mayflower. I'm a descendant of John Adams.
Really?
Yeah, of American sons and daughters of the American Revolution on my father's side. And so here is a situation where an affluent New Jersey boy goes to rural Pennsylvania and impregnates a working class girl, and it causes all sorts of havoc. But my father was a counterculturalist, so he was a far leftist. And in that era of the 60s, you know, this was quite popular, but it wasn't a good fit. And my working class mother certainly suffered because my father started to commit adultery at a very young age. As long as I can remember, my father was coming home very late at night. And I could watch slowly over time as the pain crept into my mother, and she started to take out her own rage and frustration on me. And she started to beat us, my sister and myself. I'm the oldest of three. And I developed this serious understanding that I was supposed to sacrifice myself and sort of accept suffering as sort of like the reason for my very existence. Because in that suffering, I had to protect not just myself as I was developing, but my younger sister. It's important to say this because there's a good part of radicalization that sort of has this benevolence to it, where that ability to sacrifice yourself for something greater is what kind of drives it, but that willingness to accept violence and hate in order to attain some sort of cause is the negative sort of problematic aspect of it. So a lot of times extremists have legitimate grievances. It's how we go about addressing them. And so I developed this ability to sacrifice myself for a greater cause, looked at my society as having betrayed me, and as the beatings continued and no one in my society intervened, I ran away at the age of 15 and took to the streets, first in New York City, and then became a countercultural leftist like my father. But I traveled with the Grateful Dead and these hippie bands and lived a very hippie lifestyle until I started to identify with the autobiography of Malcolm X one day in jail, and it led me down a path of searching for something that would give me stability, and I found it in Islam. But I also found activism, and in the context of the post-war on terror era, and as we ran between 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, I saw myself as someone who allied with the enemy. We were in a period where you were either with us or you were with the terrorists, and I think most of the people recognize that democracy, freedom, and the American system certainly could not be equated to the system the terrorists wanted to impose. And I chose the other side because I didn't know how to relate with the society that I was born into.
How did you get, you say you chose the other side. So how did that happen? I mean, because this was not an online thing happening at this point.
Not at the time.
So how were you drawn into it?
So there was online activity. This was the age of the internet, but it was the age that preceded the transition into social media. So there was no Facebook. So my drawn into it was I converted to Islam in Philadelphia, which has a very rich tradition of Islam in the hood that goes back to Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia created a university called Medina University, and they targeted African-American imams for disseminating their fundamentalist ultra-Orthodox view. And one of the cities that predominantly was affected by this massive oil money campaign to send fundamentalist, what we call Wahhabist Islam, took root in Newark, New Jersey, and Philadelphia. It's really the hub of a very fundamentalist community. So by haphazard circumstance, I converted in a city that gave me already exposure to people that were taking the religion seriously and taking the text seriously. But I couldn't reconcile what I had accepted as an ideology with a behavior that I was still frustrated, traumatized, suffering from addiction. And so I found myself in trouble. And I gravitated towards ultra-Orthodox Islam and a politicized interpretation of Islam when I met a recruiter in Richmond City in Virginia. I was incarcerated for 40 days, and this is where all of the criminal lifestyle just dropped, because I met a recruiter that was a veteran of the Afghan-Soviet jihad. And for 40 days, he sat and he taught me how to pray in Arabic, and he taught me how to fast, and he taught me how the rules, and he read the Quran with me. And then one day, we were in the back of the cell, and an African-American Christian stands in front of our prayer, and he won't move, because when you call the Muslim prayer, you call loudly, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. And he was perturbed by this. And there's a narration attributed to the Prophet Muhammad that says, if someone stands in front of your prayer, gently move them to the right. But if they don't move, then stand up and fight them, for verily they are a devil. So I'm not knowing this information even exists, and this little Moroccan guy gets up and tries to fight someone three times his size. So he's taught me a system and a way of life that's going to give me stability, and I have had no parenting. I have raised myself. I have been on the streets for several years, and I'm enthralled by the idea of five prayers a day, ending the trauma, having structure. This idea of not intoxicating myself is great for me. But here comes this guy who's going to get beat up, and in the end of the day, he sits back in the back of the cell, and I say, why did you fight him? And he says, well, there's a perpetual, never-ending war going on against truth and falsehood, black and white worldview, the extremist love. There's the believers, and there's the non-believers. And he says, and we're living in a very serious age of apocalypse, what they call Malhama. The battle of Armageddon in the Islamic world exists very much like it does for some fundamentalist Christians. And he says to me, he says that what has been established in Afghanistan with the implementation of Islamic law will never be tolerated by the West because they hate Islam and Muslims. And you'll soon see that they'll go to war against the Taliban in Afghanistan for establishing Sharia. And he gives me this, and he says, our obligation now is to fight for the truth. And then he gives me a apocalyptic narration of the Prophet. It says that a black flag, the same black flag that we've come to know over the past 18 years is being allied with ISIS and Al-Qaeda, will be raised in Afghanistan, and it won't be stopped until it reaches Jerusalem, where Israel, the Jewish state, is. And the anti-Semitism was able to come out then. And all I was just enraptured by this presentation of, wow, not only does this way of life offer me this complete spiritual worldview, but look at the political worldview, the revolutionary worldview. It was enthralling. And so that was an in-person interaction that set me on a trajectory that I walked out of there in the end of 2000 when the internet was already up and running. There was nowhere a place on the internet where you could access in the English language this ideology that I had just been taught. And then all of a sudden it comes to the view of everybody in the world on 9/11. And everybody's sort of sitting there and they're shocked and they're in awe. And for me, it was like, wow, what he told me was true. And I sat back and watched, and as we entered into this new era, I started to find myself identifying more with the terrorists than I did with my own people, and adopting this very black and white worldview that he planted the seed for. And then I did start to navigate online, and and start to research. And I was a quick learner. So over the years from 9/11 until 2004, when I started to preach, and 2005, when I really started to preach, I lived, breathed, ate, and slept this way of life, this system of thought.
When you say you started to preach, was this in mosques, are you saying, or preach the ideology to?
My story is very difficult because I move around so much. So when I was released from my 40 days with Hassan, who radicalized me in Richmond, I had nowhere to go. I was a hippie living on the streets up until that point. So I went, and the only place I could find to live was Syracuse, New York, in a Salvation Army. And I was in a Syracuse, New York Salvation Army, working 40 hours in their drop-in center in order to earn my bed, trying to figure out what to do, but living as a practicing Muslim. And in the aftermath of that period, the country was confused. And about 2 weeks after, they found out that I was this Muslim, and I became sort of the focus of attention. And they came to me and they asked me politely if a Christian program was a good fit for me. And they offered, they said, if you don't feel comfortable here, we'd like that you don't promote your religion or that you don't practice your religion openly. And I was okay with that, but it turned into more and more pressure. And it's okay, I understand in retrospect. It helped to radicalize me, but everybody was scared during that time. It's a tendency to react to the circumstances of the time in a way that I can get my mind around them, but I felt confused and oppressed, so to say, back then. But I brought it on myself, because I was pretty arrogant about my newfound, you know, there's no greater Catholic than a new Catholic, and there's no greater Muslim than a new Muslim. So in that context, I told them I wanted a Greyhound ticket to New York City. And so I ended up on 145th Street in New York in Harlem as a white convert to Islam who knew the religion and wasn't afraid to speak about it. And I became sort of this something to point to. It was like the white guy that is Muslim and knows how to articulate himself and loves Malcolm.
And loves Malcolm.
So I was able to, that interest that piqued my interest and curiosity in Islam, the autobiography of Malcolm X, I saw myself in the context of a post 9/11 era as being offered a gateway into becoming Malcolm X. So I started walking around on 125th Street and speaking, and I met a bookseller. And the bookseller was selling the conspiracy theory books a lot of the stuff is competent work, but he liked the idea of me speaking because people would stop. Because here's a white guy on the corner of 125th Street and Amsterdam Avenue talking about how African Americans need to go back to their roots and recognize that 30% of the people that came over on the slave ships were Muslims and that their religion had been taken away from them. And just the spiel, that was a lot of just heightened rhetoric. Some of it true, but exaggerated. And then in the critique of the Iraq War, that your loyalty should not be to this country and occupation and imperialism. I thought it was Malcolm. What it did was it opened me up to explore and make connections with even more extremist groups. I was radical then. And then one day, the Muslim Day Parade occurs every year in New York City. And they walk from 96th Street on Madison Avenue all the way downtown to like 20th Street or something. And I decided I wanted to attend. And I walk along and I'm like, look at these hypocrites, American Muslims with American flags, you know, promoting their patriotism. And the NYPD marching band was there. And I get to the bottom of the parade and I'm standing behind a Pakistani kid, and he has his one side of his face is painted green for Pakistan. The other side is red, white, and blue for the United States. And he has these flags hanging out of his backpack. And I'm like, oh, this is just disgusting. He's betraying his identity. He should solely be Muslim. And I look to the left, and here's a black flag waving in the wind. And it's an organization called the Islamic Thinkers Society. They were an offshoot of probably the largest and most notorious English language, I didn't know this then, but English language network of propagandists that were allied with Al-Qaeda in the post 9/11 era. I walked up, they had a video screen that was powered by a generator. George Bush, this crusade is gonna take a while, and then framed with these pictures of dead Muslims, and my heart starts to race, and pictures of just evoking this idea that the Americans are waging a war against Islam, and then this big poster that says the Caliphate system, the system of the Muslims is the Caliphate, Khilafah is the only solution. And they are selling t-shirts and people are gathering around the table. The t-shirt in Arabic says, I love jihad. Man, I didn't hesitate at all. I walked up to them and I said, I want to join you. And within a matter of 2 years, I became their most prominent speaker. I befriended a Jamaican cleric who was incarcerated in the UK, who had radicalized Jermaine Lindsay, one of the 7/7 bombers that attacked the subway system in 2005. And I stayed with the Islamic Thinkers Society, where I cut my teeth in learning how to promote on the street. They had street engagement, street dawah, so they called it, street proselytization. And the Jamaican cleric and me start to write each other, and he comes home at the end of 2007. Now, the interesting thing about my story is, while I'm a radicalizer going by the name of Yunus Abdullah Muhammad, I never changed my name legally. So my legal name is Jesse Morton. And Jesse Morton, in Harlem, was given access to a great program there that got me an ability to apply to school and get a scholarship to college. By this time, I was working as a certified substance abuse counselor, mental. So Islam gave me stability to get my life together, and Jesse Morton was doing great.
But he had an alter ego, two parallel worlds.
Right, so I'm Yunus Abdullah Muhammad over here when I could be. And in 2007, I always have this tendency to self-sabotage, and I get accepted to Columbia University. And so my teacher, as I start my first semester in 2007, my teacher pulls me aside and he says, I need you to talk to me every day because liberal education is going to make you leave the truth. And I was like, how dare you try to control me like that? And I got upset. But rather than open my ears up to what I was hearing at Columbia University on the campus, I shut down because I had contact with a Jamaican cleric who was even more extreme than the teacher that dropped me off at Columbia my first day of school. And rather than get less radical, I decided that I should give credence to the Jamaican. And when he came home at the end of 2007 on my Christmas break, I launched not only the very first English language jihadi magazine, but rather than the old organization doing things on the street, we were gonna do things on the street too, but we shot everything on video. And everything went uploaded to this new platform that was going viral called YouTube.
So you were at the forefront of the movement of those glorified videos.
We created it. The transition into social media 2.0 from jihadists in the English language, that was conducted by a small handful of jihadists in the English language, even before the jihadists that live in the Middle East adopted those platforms. We were the ones that paved the way for that.
So those platforms that still exist. So let's fast forward just for a moment to let our audience know what you're doing now. Your company is called Parallel Networks.
Yes, indeed.
And share with our audience what that is and what you're currently doing.
So Parallel Networks is based upon a philosophy of my taking away after a long time of reflection on how I got in and how I got out and where I should go from here. Parallel Networks is the best way that I can encapsulate what needs to happen if we're going to combat the threat posed by violent extremisms. And I use the portal because they all intersect off each other. There wouldn't be as much support for right-wing extremism if there were no jihadism. And there wouldn't be as much support for jihadism if there weren't right-wing extremism. And now we're seeing reactions on the left, that might lead to similar dynamics. So in an age of intersecting extremisms, I think that it's safe to say that the only way that we'll be able to deal with the threat is to understand that extremists offer networks that satisfy needs and they encapsulate narratives. And that the only way that we'll be able to deal with it is not by providing a message alone and in isolation. Extremists offer a message, but they don't do so just a message. They also offer meaning, significance, purpose, family, camaraderie, right, and identity, and other factors as well. It's a comprehensive, holistic system. It's an ecosystem in media. We ran a website, but we also had YouTube, Facebook. We had a 24/7 radio station. You could contact us one-on-one. Any email that we got at any hour of the day, we would respond to it. So what I'm basically doing is reverse engineering the complete ecosystemic approach I took to building and helping to build, I should say, because there was many people like me that were in on the conspiracy. Learning what I learned from doing, I'm now reverse engineering it. So a parallel network is a network that offers that same comprehensive worldview, same comprehensive ability to get 24/7 engagement, same ability to offer a coherent, not just that those people are wrong, but that here's something to believe in, but it does so on principles that are antithetical to hate and extremism. So in the same way that I use three primary principles to radicalize and recruit, I now have three primary antithetical principles that I use to promote a worldview that is antithetical to extremism in every single way.
And so how and where are you doing this?
Well, we operate, we've been up and running for about a year and a half. There is a lot of momentum. We've achieved more than I could ever imagine. I'm actually working with the director of intelligence at the NYPD that set up the very first cyber bureau to study our activity online. So while I was building this thing, the law enforcement community is saying, what are they doing? They're using the internet like this? And so they have to react to us. So the guy at the NYPD that was responsible for combating me, who I was on his desk every day for 7 years straight, is now my partner.
While I was a jihadist propagandist,
mm-hmm. and he was monitoring me on the streets of New York City in this massive game of cat and mouse, and ultimately the man who put together a portion of the evidence that was used to incarcerate me in 2011 and fly me back from Morocco to the United States, is now my partner. And so we work together to do this. And we are trying to take, you know, you can rely on academics, and there's a lot of intellectuals in the world that can figure things out cognitively. But there is no way to understand a problem better than to talk to those people that have their hands dirty in doing it. And as somebody who used to recruit and radicalize, working alongside of somebody who used to fight those that recruit and radicalize, as both, the interesting thing is we both graduated from the same school, because I'm the Ivy League terrorist and he's the Ivy League NYPD head. So we graduated from the same school, albeit him a decade earlier than me. But we both graduated from Columbia University with degrees in international relations and now have a comprehensive understanding of the literature, the field that we work in, and know that the literature, the field that we work in is deficient because we need street smarts if we're going to deal with this thing. It's not going to be something we can deal with in a book. And so we are building out an entire domestic ecosystem. We call it LightUponLight.online. We have a campaign called Control Alt Delete Hate, to control the space between stimulus and response, to recognize that human beings can get just as much in addressing a grievance and fulfillment from a non-violent means of addressing legitimate grievances as they can from violent ones. We just have to create avenues for people to have an alternative to address pain, frustration, and grievance, to control that space, to alter that course, and then to realize that in an age of intersecting extremisms, we all have something we can do, like this podcast, to delete hate, to eradicate polarization. So control, delete hate is our paradigm for personal and collective change. And then we offer shift hate, which is support and help for individuals and families touched by hate. That's a 24/7 helpline that you can call, and you can get services by a former extremist like myself on the jihadist realm. We work with former right-wing extremists. We have one former left-wing extremist. We work with former gang members. We work with victims of extremism. And we're trying to create a robust system and raise awareness in every city across this country so that people call that hotline number. Then we have Save Hate, which is our society against violent extremism and hate. This is a network of people that we call shapeshifters, people doing things locally, like yourself on your podcast, that are promoting things that are overcoming and attacking the problems that we face today at a higher order of consciousness, but putting them together in a collective, because only networks can combat networks. So we're creating a parallel network with the LightUponLight.online ecosystem, having a lot of fun doing it, making a lot of inroads and actually getting stuff to happen. We've been stuck in a quagmire with regard to whether or not government funding should be involved in this space. And we just got away from that, and we just went out and we do it. We don't make a fortune off of it. Mitch, my co-founder, he already has a quality of life and he cares about the cause. So he doesn't require a lot of funding. And we put this together, you know, basically out of the back of a trunk, if you really look at it. And we're having a lot of fun doing it, and we're learning a lot, and it's such needed activity, especially because over the year and a half that we've been up and running, things have only gotten worse.
So you said that you've engendered a lot of support. You also have engendered a lot of death threats.
Yes, this is part of the territory.
So talk to me about that.
So, I mean, anytime that you leave, the very definition, the requirement of somebody becoming a violent extremist, you can be a radical All right, and not think that everybody that disagrees with you needs killed. But where violent extremism gets dangerous is that violent extremism literally requires you to dehumanize another and to black and white, binarily, dualistically compartmentalize your world so that there is you and your group and there's everybody else. And so even other Muslims are part of the everybody else. In fact, other Muslims that don't know the true Islam are worse than everybody else. Right? And so the problem is when you commit apostasy in Islam, you become a primary target. So we have people like Ayan Hirsi Ali, who is a woman who grew up in Somalia.
I know her.
She's a beautiful woman.
I have met and interviewed her.
She's
extraordinary, and she's still in hiding.
And she lives under 24/7 surveillance with constant management, and she's a prominent figurehead that should, by all accounts, not even have to go into spaces where her life is at threat. And so, yes, I experienced the same. When you deal with extremists, anything that shatters or even casts a seed of doubt into that black and white world causes them to go into their... Well, I know for a fact that trauma has a lot to do with it. And the traumatized brain is stuck in fight, flight, or fright, right? Or freeze. And so a lot of that knee-jerk reaction is fight. Because especially when you can't argue with what I'm saying, because I can deconstruct this ideology better than 99.9% of people on the planet. If you put me in front of a jihadist scholar in the mountains with ISIS, I will refute him. Plainly, clearly, calmly, coolly. His only reaction to that is going to be, well, I can't argue with you, so I might as well kill you. And so this is what happens online. But we have to make ourselves... I used to not say this out loud, but it's the only way I can explain it and be true to myself by saying, you know, what it really is. And I don't mean to suggest that I deserve to be recognized as a martyr, but I oftentimes used to think, like, is it worth it? I work like 16-hour days. This is a lot of work. It's a lot of stress. It takes a lot of dedication. It takes a lot of ambition. And this is something no one's ever done in our country before, try to build out something that actually functions like this. And I say, you know, every day I wake up and I like, remember, I have visions of how I used to haul my table to the mosque on Fridays and set it up religiously, no matter what, rain or shine, to propagate the message. And how I was willing to die and drag my kids through mud and move to Morocco and fly and drive a woman crazy because I was stuck on my idealisms, and how I used to always turn and say, well, that's what martyrdom's for, and that's what we're racing towards, and that's what we're trying to earn. So if I was as willing to die for such a heinous ideology, I think that people in sincerity, if you were just as willing to die back then and you were sincere about it, you should be just as willing to sacrifice yourself in this realm. And we take precautions so we don't put other people at risk. And truth be told, it's a lot of hot-headed chatter at this point. This threat posed by jihadism has gone up and down and up and down. And right now we're in a period of contraction. This is the period where we need to get our hands dirty, because there's a lot of hypotheses or scenarios you could concoct in your head. Just say, we pull out of Afghanistan tomorrow, the jihadists claim victory. All of a sudden, their message has more appeal than it did 2 days ago, which looks like it might be on the horizon. Let's say there's another economic cyclical downturn like 2008. We start to suffer and they start to say, look, it's because they've been wasting their time and their money and their resources on the Muslims. Muslims are responsible for this cyclical downturn, and, you know, victory is nigh, and then the calls start to go. Let's say ISIS resurrects itself in Syria or Iraq. These things have happened repetitively. In 2011, when they arrested me 2 weeks after they took Osama bin Laden off of the battlefield, we thought the war on terror was over. And 3 years later, we were sending troops back into Iraq because ISIS announced a global caliphate. So what we're doing now is preparing, and right now there's not a whole lot of risk, I would say. I mean, it only takes one crazy. When I first started doing this in the height of the peak of ISIS in 2015, when I got out of prison and I started to work as an informant for a few years before I was outed by the Washington Post as an FBI informant, because I went back after prison and started to work in the field in the trenches with the FBI, then it was high risk. But
why did you decide to leave? What was the turning point for you?
So I threatened the writers of South Park for portraying the Prophet Muhammad in a cartoon. Now, we all, by this point, know cases of people that have caricaturized the Prophet Muhammad and have been the cause of massive international conspiracy. If there's one way you want to rile up a lot of Muslims, it's portray the Prophet Muhammad. Now, the writers of South Park, as humorous as they are, were very crafty. So they didn't portray the Prophet Muhammad. They portrayed Prophet Muhammad in a bear costume. And so humorously tried to get around the prohibition, but we still found that this would be great as a recruitment tool. And so we threatened them. We put a picture of Theo van Gogh, the ally of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, dead on a street in Amsterdam, and predicted that the writers of South Park would likely end up dead like Theo van Gogh, right? And then we also showed links to where they might be living in Colorado, which was actually their addresses. And that was the point where we had spent many years walking up to the line of free speech, but that actually broke the law, and I knew it. I wasn't responsible for the post. I issued a clarification statement, but about 2 months later, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, my old associates that had moved and joined Al-Qaeda launched another iteration of an English language magazine I started before they left, and they launched a death threat against people that were involved in the South Park scandal. They also included an article called How to Build a Bomb in Mom's Kitchen. That article, which is a continuation of a template that I established, has been used in innumerable terrorism attacks since. And so I ran because the person that originally threatened the writers of South Park tried to travel to Somalia to join Al-Qaeda's outfit in Somalia, and he was arrested. 2 days after he was arrested, I was on my way to Morocco to flee from what would ultimately be my own criminal charge. I get to Morocco. My wife is from Morocco at the time. I have one child, newborn kid, and another on the way. And I've just basically thrown away an opportunity to have any semblance of stability, thinking that I have to live there until I figure out what's going on. So I start to tutor Arab millennial youth that are wanting private tutoring for GRE and GMAT training, which are the test that will get you accepted into graduate schools in the West. Mm-hmm. These are kids that want to study in Canada, the United States, and the United Kingdom. And I'm tutoring them, and all of a sudden the Arab Spring breaks out. And here I am, this fundamentalist Muslim who believes that the future of revolution in the Middle East is supposed to lead to a caliphate, but nobody in the Middle East wants anything other than freedom of speech, right to vote in elections, and the same things that I took for granted my entire life. And so in the process of my dialogue with the students, a little seed of doubt in what I was believing in, this totalitarian, we have to force our view of the world on others, starts to recognize that there's really only way you could hold any society together is if the people want it. You can't force people to believe in anything. That's why the Middle East is not working, because Morocco surely was not working as an efficient system, not what I was used to coming from a democracy. And it cast a seed of doubt. And then I was ultimately arrested, and I spent 5 months in a Moroccan jail. And the Moroccan, they don't have a lot of different press outlets. They don't have First Amendment. So they have national press. And in the only newspaper in the country, I was on the front page, American Al-Qaeda. And so I became this legend in this jail. And a famous jihadist scholar went from one part of the jail all the way to the other because he wanted to meet me. And I thought he was coming to pay me homage and respect. And he just wants to talk to me about my life. How did I get to where I was? And he wanted to walk with me by myself, not with any of his followers around him. And he didn't know it, but a month later he was let out of prison because he had changed his views. And I felt like something was different. And so for 4 months additional after that time, I sat through a Ramadan where he started to write for the Moroccan national paper op-eds about why he was renouncing his old belief. And that was the first time I had contact. This was a man I had translated his Arabic speeches into English because they were so powerful that even English adherents would be motivated and moved by the content of his discourse. And here he gets out of prison and he changes his views, and he touched me. And this is my first contact with the power of a former extremist. The United States government came to pick me up. They flew me home on a private jet to Alexandria, Virginia, where they housed me preemptively while I awaited charges. I was facing life in prison. 23 hours a day in a cell, solitary confinement. And there was a young guard there who got to know me, and she's like, I looked into your case, and she's like, I don't understand why they have you in solitary. And you're with rapists, you're with murderers, you know, solitary's rough. And so she said, for 10 hours, 4 days a week, she would come to work. And on those shifts, she would take me for the most part of her 10-hour shift. I would go, she was third shift, so it was late at night, nobody in the jail. She would take me all the way to the law library. She'd let me up there for the whole shift, but the law library had the general library of the jail in it. And so I started to read Encyclopedia Britannica's great books of the Western world. I started to read biographies of the founding fathers. I started to get back in touch with Western roots. I read Montesquieu. I read John Locke's Tolerance and Understanding. I read Thomas Paine. I really started to reconnect with post-Enlightenment thinking, looking at religion from a very different lens. And when I converted to Islam, what I never realized, as simple as it should have been to realize, is that from the time they told me that you don't know anything and you have to learn from the feet of the scholars, if those scholars weren't educated men that had an ability to think intellectually, then that was the farthest I could do. So I had memorized everything. I had gone from being an artistic, creative human being with an ability to critically think and think for myself to being someone who would not dare think for myself inside of my religion. So here I am, 4 days a week, at least 8 hours for 4 days, just absorbing philosophy and post-Enlightenment thinking and narratives of history and biographies of great people that are all just changing the world. And I'm going back to the cell where I'm housed for 23 hours a day the rest of the week, and I'm reading the Quran and doctrine and the dogma, but now I'm reading it through a post-Enlightenment lens where I don't have a scholar there to teach it to me. So now I'm just thinking about it. And now the interpretation of the Prophet Muhammad is not as somebody who was sent as a final messenger to impose a law that he received in the 7th century upon all of humanity until the Day of Judgment. He's a reformer who was active in the 7th century and was doing things that were only appropriate for the 7th century. And why I never made that connection is because of the way extremism works. It sucks you in, and you become part of this movement that you lose yourself in it. You're part of a group. And groupthink absorbs everything that is your own independent, individualized thought. And it can happen to anybody that absorbs any ideology, even nonviolent ones. It can happen when it might be a good thing, right? But it happens. And so I reconnected with myself. And so by the time I was facing life in prison and I agreed to plead guilty to 3 charges that carried a maximum of 15 years, and in order to get that deal, I had to meet with the FBI. And the FBI comes into the room and they're like, we have to do a debriefing process, and if you lie to us, we're pulling your plea. And so here's this little white girl from New Jersey who's an FBI agent with the guy that flew me home, Secret Service. And all of a sudden, one day, this woman looks at me and she says, I think something's different about you. And I'm like, okay, here we go with the good cop, bad cop thing. Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to stop that now, people. But over time, it became apparent that she was thinking that there was something different, and she was learning, and she was asking questions, and it was weird because she seemed real different, real nice. And a kid was locked up with me in solitary, and he had gotten arrested shooting at the Pentagon, and he had done some damage to the Arlington Cemetery, and he tells me that there's 2 people out there that are waiting to carry out the attacks I had planned. And I don't know. I was faced with the conundrum, do I tell the FBI or not? And I told him, I said, it might be just jailhouse rhetoric, but it ended up being true. And that was the beginning of the development of trust that by the time I got sentenced to 11 and a half years, the judge called me up to the courtroom, to his podium, and he said, Mr. Morton, I hear really good things, and I'd like to resentence you in front of me someday, so I'm going to give you an opportunity to live close to your family and to continue to work with the FBI agents. And a lot of my students started popping up in Syria. And so a lot of those students were the ones that were radicalizing and recruiting and trying to give people the operational skills they needed to carry out attacks. They were operating from Raqqa. And they were willing to buy into a narrative that they were sending me clandestine emails to anonymous email accounts, that my wife was writing those emails down and giving them to me in contact visits, and then I was able to handwrite responses. And in reality, the FBI was able to thwart the information, and we were able to ascertain where they were and the plots that they were up to. And the FBI then started to realize that I was real, and they started to ask more and more questions about how they might be able to deal with this threat domestic, and we started to develop relationships, and I became just, the woman that advocated for me in the FBI, I will be forever indebted. They were amazing, the black and white worldview eradicated, and went back in front of a judge, and they said that it was some of the most extensive cooperation they'd ever seen, and they left me out after 3 years and 8 months.
Wow.
And so by the time I hit the streets, I had completely deconstructed my worldview. But I was in there when Boston Marathon bombings happened, and the people that did those Boston Marathon bombings used the recipe that we published in that magazine.
How did that make you feel?
I vomited on that one. I was in there when I met this one kid. He met me when I was active, and he didn't know anything. He was an idiot, kid from Florida. And I watched him radicalize, and I radicalized him. And he wrote me a letter from Syria, and he said, "I'm sitting here swimming. We've just announced the caliphate. And I'm in the Tigris and the Euphrates, and we're having tea. And I'm here with brothers from all over the world, from Belgium, from France, from the UK, and they all know who you are, and they send their thanks and their gratitude because they all say that you played a role in their arriving at the truth. And I certainly hope that the West doesn't intervene, because if they do, they're going to regret it, because we have brothers here that they don't even know about that are all ready to go back to their countries of origin and carry out attacks at the will of the state. We're growing, brother, and I feel honored that I'm able to live through this time when the caliphate is reestablished." I preached the reestablishment of the caliphate for years. I went numb. That to be confronted with that, he then sent an email later that talked about how he was in a shootout with a Shiite in a building in Aleppo and had his leg blown off and was flown to the seventh heaven and had a vision of paradise in front of him and knew he was on the true way, and he's dead now. And I met him, and he was just a kid. Just an ignorant kid. And so, yeah, those are the kind of stories that while I was in prison, nothing I could do. And you feel like you're betraying people, but this is also a person who was then residing in Raqqa, Syria, sending operational instructions to people in the West that were not any longer being told to come join ISIS, but were now being told to go out and decapitate people in the street. So it was a rough time to look at the fact that if you had asked me whether or not my preaching would have had an impact to the point that ISIS did, I would have told you, there's no way. We're just a fringe group.
So when you look back at that, obviously you've dedicated your life at this point to try to correct the wrongs. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with knowing what you did? And literally the lives that were lost as a result of your actions.
I wake up every day and I do everything I can do to make amends without burning out. Because there's a lot of work to do in this realm now. And it's not just the jihadists, and it's not just the right wing. It's the jihadists, truth be told, and it's a long story, they're having their way with us. They're one step away from destroying the United States and the unipolar system that we had on 9/11.
So what are we not doing that we should be doing to keep that from happening?
You could think of 9/11 as a provocation that was trying to lure us into behaving in a way that was not congruent with ourselves. And in some ways, they achieved that. Not all of us. But we have to learn how to react to hate in ways that are truly empathetic. And that's hard to accept, but it's really what has built the ability of things like the civil rights movement was successful, not because people were threatening violence. The most successful aspects of the civil rights movement were those that Martin Luther King attacked it at a level of consciousness that was greater. Instead of bickering, he was singing, right? But singing in a way that tapped into the root and the ethos of the era. Creativity. One of the three principles we use in developing our parallel networks are three. The promotion of a global democratic identity, that we are all one tribe. And that in a world blanketed by nation states, nationalism is good. It allows for governance and it allows for everything, but it's beginning to be outdated because we're all interconnected and our identities are transnational now. But that we still need to preserve some semblance of democracy. that democracy has given us the miracle that is development over the past 200 years, and creative pacifism, that creativity and consciousness separates man from beast, and that the only thing that's ever led to change that's been sustainable and progressive has been art and the utilization of creativity to attack narrow-mindedness with a creative response that's of a higher order of consciousness. And that takes us to our third principle, which is an enlightened humanism, that we don't need to measure everything that we do, that sometimes you can just act on principle and you can induce an enlightened reaction to something that just in that moment, if you're acting upon principle and you're sincere, everything around you feels that and it resonates. So I really think that what we have to do and what we're doing wrong is that we are allowing ourselves out of fear, fight, and flight, just like the terrorists want, to react in ways that polarize. We have a big problem with right-wing extremism right now, but we're basically equating anybody with a MAGA hat on to the next El Paso shooter. And that's what they did when I was active. They said that we were representative of the general American Muslim community, and we were laughing. Because what we did was we created the far right wing's hatred of the Muslims. And what that did was that gave us the polarization that we needed to say to the Muslim world, look at what the West really thinks about Muslims. You can't even have a mosque at ground zero.
So we played right into your hands.
And we wanted the right wing threat to come. And what we knew is if the right wing threat comes and they have to address that, the left is going to react, not with violence, but they're going to demonize, and democracy can't flourish in hyperpolarization. And it's written in the doctrine. I could take you to the text of Osama bin Laden himself, captured in the Abbottabad documents that were found in his home, where he said we need to force polarization because we're waging a war of attrition. He said all we have to do is go to any country in the world and raise the black flag and send two warriors. And they go wave there, and the Americans will waste money to spend treasure and gold and resources to try to address that threat. And he said, and it's easy to bait them. But he said, we can think the domestic situation at home is, he described it as a dam separating two people, two villages. And he said that if we sailed with the Mujahideen waving the black flag up this river, right, we could shatter the dam because one people would go against the other people in how to combat the threat that was posed by a very small, insignificant number, but by exaggerating it, it could actually explode the dam. And he talked about how the war on terror was not just the embroilment of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, but it had to do with their economic situation and how they were dealing with their health care and how they were dealing with their gun problem. This is all documented. And ISIS comes along with a doctrine called the management of savagery. This is that we need to force polarization in the West because democracy, as much as they tout it, can't work if they're divided into two camps. It'll burn itself out, they'll eat each other. And then in the place of them fighting and bickering, we can replace it. We create savagery and chaos so that we can manage it. They called it the management of savagery, and it's their doctrine.
And what's the next step in that doctrine?
To watch democracy fail and to watch catastrophe at home. ISIS just released their weekly newsletter last week and talked about the rising threat posed by right-wing extremists and the reaction domestically to the re-election of 2020 as the impending sign that victory is on the horizon. And this is the indication that they'll be back in Iraq as soon as that collapses and falls.
And if I'm understanding what you're saying, we are the ones that have the power to change that by not allowing the divisions to happen and take place.
We quote Viktor Frankl all the time. He said, there's a space between stimulus and response. And he said, and in that space lies your avenue to growth and power. Because you can attack an Einstein. We always quote Einstein. It's just important because he said it better than any. He said, there's never been a problem that's been solved by attacking it at the same level of consciousness that created it. We need a new enlightenment. We need a shift in thinking. We need to stop allowing ourselves to be provoked. And because that's what the animal does. You kick a dog. If the animal's an angry dog, he'll bite you. If he's not an angry dog, he'll run away. Right? But both are just rote responses. It's stimulus response, stimulus and response. The human being can react in multitudinous ways and can come back and combat that kick in a way that conversates about it, or that asks, why did you kick me in the first place? Or that shows the person the negative ramifications of kicking.
It's about being present
In the moment.
In the moment, taking time to stop, listen, think, be, just be before you react.
There's a tribalistic component inside of all of us. We are animals at the end of the day, but we are also of a higher order. So when we are stimulated, we tend to want to be tribal, and we tend to want to us and them, and to be with our tribe against another tribe. It makes the world easy. But we know when we live long enough and we take our time and we think that the world is much more complex than that. And empathy is what we should build our societies on, because through the exercise of empathy, nobody can be demonized because you see so many commonalities.
Exactly.
I'm not a supporter of white nationalism, nor necessarily, I think Donald Trump has some serious issues. But I have to also take a step back and say, at the end of the day, he's a man, and the reason that people like him is because he presents himself as a person full of flaws, and he embraces his flaws, and they like it because he doesn't represent trying to betray or portray himself as somebody that he's not. They consider him authentic. And we don't have a lot of authenticity in our culture today. Our culture is a little bit toxic, and it's very prone to blame the other in order to feel better about ourselves. Because we have an age of narcissism. We need, when you talk with somebody that you disagree with, when I talked with that FBI agent and I had that breakthrough moment where I was like, I don't even care if this is good cop, bad cop. She is so interesting and so empathetic with the way she's talking to me. I'm just going to give this a shot and be real. And that's where that breakthrough moment occurs. And all, I mean, people would be dead if that moment never happened. Right? And that was the beginning of me getting my life back. That was the beginning of my children knowing their father again. And it's just an isolated moment where a person who can say, you're the enemy of Islam and Muslims, oh, maybe you're not. Because I have to put myself in your shoes. And when I can do that, and it can happen any day and all day long, if we just walk around and we slow down in our interactions with the other, and we say, you know what, if I react like that, am I really reacting in a way that's any better than the way that they see me? And there's all kinds of ways. And then when you really pause and you're like, well, what's the real way to respond? Like, you can think of all these miraculous ways, like what we just did here today at Baylor. We had a conversation with a collective consciousness formulated in the room, and many people didn't even know there is this thing called countering violent extremism. And we imparted new ideas and new thoughts out there about how to deal with this threat that's posed, right? And in turn, people are going to go and they're going to have other conversations. And so it's that whole, you know, that's the response that can really address the grievance. And if your grievance is, unjust policies the United States oversees, even little things like that can actually have an impact on that, and they're unrelated. It's all about consciousness, I really think, that a heightened consciousness and a shift in the way that we think, I like to call it a new enlightenment, whatever. It's not about using big words or words that sound empowering.
It's mindfulness.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah. But to practice it is real. And I live that. And it's interesting because when you get away from that and you're like, okay, reassess. What's the last week been like? And you're like, okay, so you left that. So get back on that. It's a conscious thing, but it's in the cultivation of that that it begins to be second nature. And that's what we need to do collectively, I think.
You mentioned your children. They're young still. What, 8 and 9?
8 and 9 years old.
8 and 9.
Yes.
How much do they know about your past?
They definitely know that Daddy has an interesting life. So they definitely know that Daddy's sometimes on TV and that he's sometimes on documentaries, and they sometimes see. And they also know that Daddy works very hard, because good thing about being employed in your own organization is that you can basically work as you go. The bad thing when you're a daddy and you own your own organization is sometimes your kids got to go with you to meetings. And so you have to kind of try to combat what they can hear, what they can take in. But I decided that I'm just going to let them see my example. And they definitely know, but they don't know because they couldn't comprehend.
Right.
But in the Islamic tradition, we have a 21-year system for raising children, right? And for 7 years, and their first 7 years of life, you play with them. And for then 7 years, you teach them. And then for the final period, the final phase of the third 7-year process, you befriend them. So when they hit that 14-year-old point, I think we're going to go somewhere and sit and have a nice long conversation about who your daddy is, was, and what you should take from that and how you should understand that. And then hopefully by that time I'll have an accumulated amount of data that they'll say, okay, Dad, so you're almost making up for what you did, right? So we hope. And, you know, and then that's another way you can make amends is by raising good children, you know? So we hope that they grow up to do good conscious raising stuff as well.
What do you want people who are listening to your story to take away from it?
The power of transformation. Individuals can change. And that the power of empathy in inducing, it's almost like when you're, if I could tell you what it's like to go from being someone who didn't know anything about empathy into totally trying to exercise it every day. It doesn't, it's not what you're doing for the other people because you're empathetic now. Inside of yourself, a whole new world opens up. It's a whole different way of seeing things. So you don't get caught and mired in these political debates that dominate our collective consciousness right now as a society, because, and you don't judge those that do, you just do something about it. And then avenues like contact with people that you otherwise would have never come into contact with, and conversation actually has meaning. It's not just about, you know, which movie on Netflix is the best thing to watch. It's not just about what football team is going to go on to win the Super Bowl. It becomes, it's important. And that's what we need to do as a society. We need to start having conversations that touch into your emotions. We don't get enough of that. We don't walk away from enough of our daily engagements with human beings and feel like, yeah, I just talked to another human being. We're too focused on where we're going to next. When we live in the now and we exercise empathy, then every single person we come across on the street throughout the course of the day is an opportunity to teach or to learn or just to be human. And that's a very different world than the one that extremists live in. So, but I think sometimes everybody can forget that. So,
in your private, quiet moments, do you ever shed tears about your past?
I won't say it's just about the past. I shed tears about how difficult it is. I am traumatized. I have been through a lot. I would be a liar if I said that I was not fatigued from the journey.
How old are you?
I'm 40, but I feel like I'm older than 40. And I've been in prison, I've been in solitary confinement, I've been tortured. I've been hateful, I have been hated, I have been constantly trying to find a space of stability. As long as I have been on Earth, I've been trying to recover from the damage of trauma. And I cry because I realize that we are all traumatized to a degree. And so I cry really for the sake of, it hurts for us all today. Unfortunately, I have to say that I got into extremism, was interested in extremism because society was failing me. And that was in the late 90s. And when I look at our society today and the lack of engagement, the lack of human interaction, I cry because there's not a lot of connection right now. And so I cry more of a collective cry at this point. But inside of that collective cry is that internal me. And that's a manifestation of the trauma too. So I'm still healing.
All about human connection. Mm-hmm. Jesse, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your story and sharing all of who you are and giving us a lot to think about and some really important takeaways and some clear guidelines for how we can literally save ourselves, and it's about connecting with each other.
Thank you for having me and for the work that you're doing as well. God bless you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see you next time. I'm a firm believer that if we can find a way to better understand each other's experiences, we can find a way to accept and respect each other for who we are, even when we don't agree. That's the ultimate goal of this podcast. So with that in mind, what do you want the world to know about your story?
how might your story, your truth, provide an important perspective to help bridge our divides? If you'd like to share your story with us for a chance to be featured on the podcast, all you have to do is go to our website, ourvoicesmatterpodcast.com, and click on What's Your Story? We can't wait to hear from you, because your voice matters.